It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. At the turn of the 20th century, 70% of Americans lived in small towns. Today, it's closer to 20%. Many of the most influential Americans started their lives in small towns. And today, we'll talk about some remarkable individuals and also explore what it means to come from a small town. Then, and now, my first guest today is John Miller, Professor Emeritus of History at South Dakota State University and author of the new book, Small Town Dreams, Stories of Midwestern Boys Who Shaped America. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Charity. Very happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And you come from not just one small town, but what, six small towns when you were growing up?
Six small towns. My father was a Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor, the kind that traveled around a lot. And I was born in Kansas, grew up in four towns in Missouri, one in Illinois, and to contrast with that, one rapidly growing suburb of Chicago for 3.5 years.
So what made you want to research and write about small towns at this point in your life?
Well, you know, as a professional historian, one of the things you do is research. I've always loved to write from a very young age and always anticipated I would write. My first book was a political history, a biography of Governor Phil Laffoulette of Wisconsin, and once I had that off the table, I needed to go another direction, and I had a choice between intellectual history, which I had a fascination with, and as I was living in the town of Brookings, South Dakota, and had my experience behind me, I thought small towns are an understudied subject, and I'd like to go that direction.
One of the big questions that I'm sure a lot of people will have as we start this conversation, even having just listened to the title of the book, Stories of Midwestern Boys Who Shaped America, why did you choose to focus on men?
That's a question that's always said. Okay, well, let me go back and say that my first book after my my revised dissertation was a book called Looking for History on Highway 14, which was really about small towns. And one of the towns on Highway 14 in South Dakota was DeSmet, the home of Laura Ingalls Wilder from age 12 to 27. And so I wrote about this small town girl. You could say my purpose, the original article I wrote was called Place and Community in DeSmet. It was all about trying to unlock what a small town was like in the early 1880s. That led over a period of about 12 years to two more books on Laura Ingalls Wilder. And by that time, I thought, I want to do something on small town boys, because after all, I was a small town boy, and I felt I had a somewhat of an empathy and sensitivity toward that. So my answer to that question, which always arises, is I'm waiting for a small town girl's book. I just can't wait to read it. Also, this book is 440 pages of text plus 60 pages of footnotes, and I don't know how long the book would have to be, maybe 1,200
pages. Right. Well, you feel that in history, small towns have been overlooked in many ways. And I quoted that statistic that around the turn of the 20th century, around 1900, 70% of Americans lived in small towns. Why do you think they've been overlooked when we've been writing history?
Well, you know, that's interesting because my very first chapter on Frederick Jackson Turner, the famous frontier of the historian of the frontier, historian of the frontier and of sectionalism, who taught at the University of Wisconsin, where I picked up my PhD, actually spent a little time talking about small towns, which I think was an aberration. But in the 1960s and 70s, the field of urban history really exploded in the United States. And for whatever reason, it focused on the big cities, on the suburbs, on the edge cities, on suburbanization. And I think it's largely because of the statistic you just read, that more and more of these historians were coming out of the suburbs and the cities and writing about their own experience, whereas most of those early prairie historians that John Lauck has written about so eloquently in his book, The Lost Region, about the revival of Midwestern history, almost all of those were small-town boys. and many of them from the Midwest. And so I think a lot of it has to do with personal biography and background.
Now, let's talk about what small towns were like around the turn of the 20th century, because, of course, they were a lot more important at that point than they are now, because the majority of the population lived in small towns. But it was also a time of incredible change.
That is correct. Well, a question like that opens up so many avenues. We've got to focus a little bit here. I would say, first of all, think about what the function of a town is. And in the early days, you know, in New England, there was a church, and there's always the you have to have an economic function. And out here in the Middle West, many, if not most, of the small towns were established on railroads as they, you know, pushed west across the country. They were essentially agricultural service centers, although they had other functions like governmental functions and cultural functions and so forth. And so what demanded many small towns was, in a horse and buggy era, you know, the farmers would bring their products to market and they'd come into shop in the small towns. And having a small town every 8, 10, 12 miles along the railroad was very functional, even necessary. And once trucks and automobiles got on the road, my second chapter's our third chapter is about Henry Ford and the Model T. You know, you just simply did not need that many small towns to service the farmers, and small towns were going into decline population-wise already by the 1920 census and certainly by the 1930 census, and they've been draining out ever since, which obviously you could see if you just take a drive out around Iowa any day of the week.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about Henry Ford, because he is a small town guy who did dramatically change small towns all over the United States and really all over the world, although somebody was going to do it. He's the guy who did it. But what did it mean to him to come from a small town?
Well, you know, just to be specific, he did grow up on a farm near a small town, and a number of my boys grew up on a farm, you know, 2, 3, 4, 10 miles, often quite close. Ernie Pyle, Alvin Hansen, Henry Ford, Lawrence Welk, and so forth. But they were closely identified with the small town they were near because, you know, they'd drive the hogs in the market or they'd bring a load of wheat in or something. And Henry Ford, like so many of these guys, just couldn't wait to get out of Dodge, as they say, although for him, getting out of Dearborn was just going 10 miles east to Detroit. And, of course, it was in Detroit where he made his fortune building the Model T Ford. And then in his dotage, you could say, or by the time he was in his 60s, he started reminiscing more. He didn't have to think so much about adding more hundreds of millions to his pile of money. And he began to recall with affection and nostalgia what that time had been back on the farm and in the small town of Dearborn, and how life was a little slower and people were a little closer to each other in that way.
And of course, he didn't just reminisce. He decided that he needed to preserve and recreate.
He did. And of course, you know, when people ask me, how did you decide who to put in this book? I always, the first thing was, besides the fact that they provided a great story, each one of these 22 men has a great story to tell, but they all had to have been strongly influenced by their memories of living in the small town or on the farm to get in the book. It was a self-selected, you know, I didn't put anybody in here who wasn't influenced. And as he began thinking about history, he preserved a couple of inns or wayside inns, one in New England and one near Detroit. And then he got this idea of a historical museum and what he called Greenfield Village, which as an aside, I might say, my wife and I went there on the first day of our honeymoon when we got married 40 years ago.
Well, and it's part of the Henry Ford, which is a huge museum complex.
That is right.
But Greenfield Village, for Iowans who haven't been there, it is a little like Living History Farms.
Yes.
but it is at least 10 times bigger. And
right.
and not only preserves what it's like, or what it was like to be on a farm before the turn of the century or at the turn of the century, but also different kinds of villages and then amazing historical artifacts. I mean, the Wright Brothers bicycle shop is there, and Menlo Park, where the light bulb was invented, is there. I mean, it's a remarkable place.
Yeah, it's some of the people in my book, like there's a cabin that George Washington Carver lived in as a boy, and he's one
It's a recreation of the cabin that he lived in as a boy, but he actually went there and spent a night in that cabin, so you can say George Washington Carver slept there.
That's exactly right. And, you know, Ford was like, I would say, almost all these guys. He had this affection for and nostalgia about his boyhood, but he also was very ambivalent about that background. He wouldn't have wanted, you know, none of these men ever wanted to go back to move permanently to the small town or the farm they grew up on, although many of them went back to visit them many times. Their fortune was made by leaving and going to the places where they could get the job or pursue the profession that they wanted to get in. And Ford certainly was the one who stayed closest to his origins, because he never really lived more than a few miles or the most, you know, 10 miles away in Detroit throughout his entire life.
Did he reflect? I mean, obviously he did a great deal to preserve history. Did he reflect on what it meant to grow up in a rural environment?
You know, one thing about Ford is he wrote a lot, but who knows if he actually wrote it. Ford was a genius in some ways, but he also was very ignorant in others. He never was a very good speller. He had very good publicists who wrote a lot of his columns in the newspaper that he bought. Not everybody can buy a newspaper just to promulgate their ideas and the books that he wrote. So what he wrote and what publicists wrote for him is always a question. And yet, just like when a president gives a speech, it's his ideas, whoever provided the words for them.
Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with historian John Miller. He is the author of the new book, Small Town Dreams, Stories of Midwestern Boys Who Shaped America. We're going to talk about a number of remarkable individuals over the next 15 minutes or so. And then at the end of the hour, we're going to take a look at what it means to come from a small town today. I will talk with the chair of the Sociology and Anthropology Departments at Iowa State University, Paul Lasley, about how small towns have changed and what it means to come from one. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about small towns and some of the remarkable people who have come from small towns. Later in the hour, we'll talk about what it means to come from a small town today. My guest right now is John Miller. He is a historian and author of the new book, Small Town Dreams, Stories of Midwestern Boys Who Shaped America. And there are so many fascinating stories in this book, but I want to talk about two individuals who came from a marginalized population in the United States, and we're still talking about this time around the turn of the century, leading up to the turn of the century. And these two individuals are George Washington Carver and Oscar Michaud. And I think that many Iowans, of course, know the story of George Washington Carver because he spent so many of his formative years here, and he's one of my favorite people to talk about. But I want to focus on Oscar Michaud because this is a story that I don't think as many people are familiar with. But what made you want to include these two men?
Well, you know, I knew absolutely I was going to have some minority people in this book, and I thought long and hard about who to put in, and these sprang to mind as possible complementary. Michaud, and there are several others in this book that are going to be somewhat unknown, but everybody else from Carson to Lawrence Welk to Grant Wood and Bob Feller, for instance, are pretty well known. But Michaud was one of those people who had a remarkable career, and yet he was almost entirely unknown in the white population until, I'd say, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. In fact, while I was working on this book, the two biographies that have been written on him were published, and he's become better known. He's gotten an award from Hollywood at the Academy Awards, and he started out as a homesteader, a black homesteader in South Dakota, where he claimed to have been the only black person in the entire area down in South Central South Dakota,
which is a believable claim.
And that happened to be, you know, 1904, when they had a land lottery and Harry Truman came up from Independence, Missouri, and tried to buy some land or, you know, get in on the cheap land. And if he had been successful, we'd have never heard of Harry Truman, who was another person I thought about putting in the book. And then when the drought of 1911 came along, he had been very successful for about 7 years, but now he was burned out, you could say, and he had to find a new way to make a living. So he decided, I'll write a novel about this thing, despite the fact he had never written anything of any length. And he sold it door to door. He got it self-published. He wrote two more based on his experience. Then he got involved in the movie business, and he reinvented himself as a second time as a movie maker.
Which is such a surprising
that's amazing
avenue to take. And as a movie maker, he had no training.
No training at all.
And no money.
And he had no training as a novelist either. But, you know, this guy, I don't know if he's kind of like the music man, you know, coming into a town and selling horns to people.
And making dreams come true.
And making dreams come true. And exactly. These are guys who had unbelievable ambition and grit and ability to go through hard times and raise himself up after that and just keep on going. And well, the thing about it was, there's another thing about all this is the timing. There's so much dependent on timing, like Henry Ford with his automobile, just getting in on the beginning of the automobile industry, and Sam Walton with the big box stores and so forth was right there at exactly the right time. But since there was virtually no competition among black movie makers, very few at all, he was the guy who was out there, and the very first movie that he made was shown in an armory in Chicago in 1920 or 21. 8,000 people were there, and they loved it. And if we went back and watched these movies today, we'd have to laugh because they're so primitive. But when you're the only guy in the business or one of the few people in the business, you know, you have a pretty good opportunity to succeed.
Absolutely. Well, let's move a little bit into the future. You write, yes. You write about different individuals who come of age at different times. And,
right.
And of course, I'm struck already by the stories that we've talked about. Mm-hmm. These men, if they came from small towns and they wanted to pursue an education, they had to leave.
Right.
The small towns that they were in, which is still, for the most part, true today.
Sure.
You talked about the success of Oscar Michaud in the 1920s. And, of course, the 1920s were a time when many people were very successful and small towns were really thriving.
Mm-hmm.
And then that period was followed by the most punishing period in the history of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Great Depression came along, and even in the 20s, you know, when small towns were thriving to a degree, they were facing the pressures of economics after World War One, when they had greatly expanded their operations and gone into debt, and then prices fell out of the bottom. All over the Midwest, you could see old banks on main streets from South Dakota to Ohio that went out of business, you know, in the mid-1920s because the farmers went broke. But be that as it may, the farmers, in a sense, were undone by their success, because as they got bigger and larger, the ones that succeeded squeezed all the small ones out, so they couldn't really win for losing. In bad times, they suffered, and in good times, the small ones were driven out by the larger ones, and that meant fewer farm wagons down on Main Street and less business for the stores on Main Street, so the small towns suffered either way.
I was surprised when I picked up the book to see that you included the novelist Sinclair Lewis.
Oh, yes.
And he was from a small town, but obviously as a novelist, he wrote the very famous book Main Street,
right,
which is one of the most scathing send-ups of small-town life ever printed.
Right. Well, I thought that was a no-brainer because, you know, Main Street is the prototypical book that people go to if they want to understand small-town life. And I love that. I just love that book today. Being a historian, I guess I can afford to say that because English majors, you know, usually look down their nose at it. But the point about this chapter especially, I think, is that for all the scathing things that Lewis said about small towns in Main Street in 1920, which made him not only the biggest bestseller of that year and the whole first half of the 1920s, but the first winner of the Nobel Prize in American literature in American history, Lewis himself admitted later on that he wasn't all negative about small towns. He had some good thoughts about them. He was very ambivalent about them, which he wrote about in the 1931 high school yearbook. And that has to be remembered. I'm a complexity kind of guy. I'm a two-handed historian, I've always said. And you got to look at all sides of the issue and not just at the cartoon images that we often have in our minds about these people.
Well, you write about Sinclair Lewis.
Yes.
You write about a trio of artists. Of
right.
course, Grant Wood is the one that we know the best
sure.
in Iowa. But Thomas Hart Benton and John Stuart Curry, three men who really shaped a lot of what the rest of the nation thought about small
right.
towns and
right.
rural life because right. of their paintings.
Right.
You also write about Meredith Willson, and here's
yes.
another person
huh.
who really shaped, and of course
oh.
later on,
yeah.
but really shaped the impression of those who didn't come from
yeah.
small towns about what small towns in the Midwest were like.
Yeah, you know, telling you a little bit of my personal biography, I think it was our 30th wedding anniversary. We went to the Chan Hessen Dinner Theater over by Minneapolis to watch The Music Man. I just love that. And Garrison Keillor was in Iowa last Saturday, I know, and playing those songs that are so memorable.
Right.
Wilson, I think, is my favorite guy in the whole book just because he was such a positive fellow. He always had a positive outlook on life. He was always enthusiastic, and he was continually talking about his growing up in that small town of Mason City, Iowa.
You do point out
yeah.
that he got the heck out of Mason City as quickly as he could,
as he
graduated
you know,
from high school.
I had already written this chapter, and I only make a note in a footnote, if you looked closely, that it was only after I had written the chapter and these two biographies came out, one by a writer of the Mason City Globe Gazette who got into the court cases to discover that his parents went through this very nasty divorce a little bit after he left, and he never talked anything about this in his lifetime, but I think he must have grown up in a household where there was lots of friction, and despite all that, you know, he wrote a play about a town of 2,012 people, River City, which was not at all like the Mason City, which from 1910 to 1915 grew from, if I recall, 12,000 people to 17,000 people in 5 years, was producing automobiles, putting on airplane shows, was the largest manufacturer of clay tiles in the world. And, you know, you'd never get any notion of six and seven story tall buildings. You'd never get any notion from watching The Music Man.
Right. No, but he did always have a fondness for Mason City and for Iowa and maintained ties.
He did. He came back often. He came back after The Music Man opened on Broadway and was such a success. And then when they made the movie in 1962, he came back again with tens of thousands of people lighting the streets, and he jumped out of the car and grabbed the baton and kicked his knees up. I have a friend here at South Dakota State University who led the band for a long time, and he remembers being there. And everybody just had a smile on their face at that.
I'm talking with John Miller. He is the author of the new book, Small Town Dreams, Stories of Midwestern Boys Who Shaped America. And you move on into the future and close to the present, although the two were some of the most recent men you write about, of course, started out in small towns quite some time ago.
Right.
But You write about Lawrence Welk and Johnny Carson, two performers who came from small towns in the Midwest. You also write about Ronald Reagan, and he was a man who, again, liked to wear on his sleeve that he was born in a small town and shaped by that.
He did. You know, Ronald Reagan, like so many of our recent presidents, was difficult to fathom. Once you looked at him closely, he was full of many, many layers, and even his wife, Nancy, who understood him best, said she didn't really understand him. But he went back to Eureka College a dozen times, twice while he was president, and he enjoyed reminiscing about Dixon. And yet, you know, the first thing he did was go to Des Moines be a radio announcer, and then go to L.A. and become a movie star. And the image he always projected, if you go to his library in Simi Valley, he's there in a cowboy hat and, you know, Western togs. And he really identified more as a Westerner than as a Midwesterner. So it's complicated, just as so many of these stories are.
Absolutely. Well, you chose to write about another contemporary man, and I can imagine there's some controversy here because you wrote about Sam Walton, and, of course, the founder of Walmart. And Walmart has changed the face of small towns almost as much as Henry Ford did with the automobile. And and a lot of people from small towns don't like what has happened to their communities because of Walmart.
Yeah, you know, most of these fellows were important in many ways. Many of them made a lot of money, but not many of them really had a huge impact. And Walton, by all odds, along with Ford, had the biggest impact of all. We've got a Walmart store in our town, just as they are all over the world, certainly all over the United States. Yeah, and if Walton had known what was going to happen, I wonder, because once early on when he had about a half dozen stores and was telling some buddies that he expected to have a dozen eventually, his wife about fell off her chair. He located all those early stores in small towns, but he never admitted that what he was doing, in fact, often had a negative effect, especially on the towns that didn't have the Walmart in them, you know, the ones whose people all drove 5, 10, or 30 miles to do their business at Walmart. So it's a very amazing story. And if he hadn't have done it, though, you know, I mean, he was just doing what the Kmarts and the other big box stores, Targets, are doing too.
So as you wrote about these men, you mentioned right at the beginning of our conversation that you felt like small towns have been overlooked in history. Does it matter? Does it matter that these men came from small towns?
Well, first of all, as in all things, you should say relatively. It's not that there haven't been books on small towns, but they've certainly been underwritten about and reported by historians and by others, I think. Does it matter? I think so. Projecting here, psychological projection as a boy from a small town. I'm not saying that everybody should have grown up in a small town, but I think as an alternative way of living and as providing a different kind of way of looking at life, yes, I think that we benefit from not having everybody living in cities like Chicago, where my son lives, or Ann Arbor, where my daughter lives, that we have these smaller places where people can live a little bit closer to nature and remind us of that, and where people are more community-oriented. It's easier to be community-oriented anyway. I think we're losing a lot as these small towns disappear, and yet it's hard to see how we can avoid what seems to be the inevitable drying up of many of them.
When you told me about your personal history, that you came from six different small towns, you moved so much. I mean, when we think about somebody coming from a place, we think about them really spending their formative years there and really being shaped by the community that they come from. And with as much as you moved around, I would be surprised if you had that kind of experience.
Well, you know, I've obviously thought about this a lot. I think that all that moving around, and each time we moved, I think all of us kids, I was the oldest of five, you know, oh, we don't want to go. We'll miss our friends. But as soon as we got to the new place, you know, we adapted quickly, including Rolling Meadows, Illinois, the suburb of Chicago that had 10,000 people in it by the time we got there, 4 years after the first house had been built there. And so I consider myself a very adaptable guy who, like my son, who after leaving Brookings has lived in two of the four largest cities in America, Houston and Chicago. He just loves it in Chicago. And while he doesn't know who his neighbors are, and he lives on a street where there's a guy from Brookings a few years younger than him, and until we pointed out that there were these two guys living on the same street in Chicago, they never would have known each other. Ultimately, behind small towns and behind the subject of place, this book is about community and how people relate to each other one-on-one, group by group. And it's about what we want America to be ultimately and how we can establish a better way of interacting with each other.
Well, John, thank you so much for talking with me today.
I really had fun.
John Miller is the author of Small Town Dreams, Stories of Midwestern Boys Who Shaped America. In a moment, I'll talk with sociologist Paul Lasley. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we've been talking about remarkable individuals who come from small towns. And of course, there are many remarkable individuals who live in small towns in Iowa today. The population of small towns has changed dramatically over the last century. But what about the culture? What does it mean to be from a small town in 2014? To answer those questions, we've asked Paul Lasley to come and talk with us. He is the chair of the Sociology and Anthropology Departments at Iowa State University. Hello, Paul.
Good morning, Charity.
Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. I've been enjoying your interview with John Miller. Delightful interview.
Well, thank you, Paul. And you have done an incredible amount of research about rural sociology, small towns, farm life in Iowa in this century and some of the last century as well. So as our small towns have changed, the populations have decreased, a lot of small towns have gone through a lot of economic hardship. That has changed the way that people live there, hasn't it?
Well, indeed. We have a number of communities across the Midwest that have experienced out-migration, economic decline, and stagnation. Something that we've talked about on this program before, a major concern, not only for Iowa, but across the Midwest, and you and John touched upon that a bit. Not only was the Great Depression of the 1930s, perhaps the first decline in many rural communities, and that sort of stabilized with the outbreak of World War II, which brought sort of renewed prosperity to many communities with higher commodity prices. But after World War II, the urbanization and out-migration of rural communities, and that has persisted fairly constant for many farm-dependent, agriculturally-dependent communities across the Midwest. Now, there are certainly exceptions, and there are rural communities that are growing, but the vast majority of them have been stagnant to declining now for 80 years.
Well, and we did have a period of prosperity after World War II that went on for some time, but then we did hit the 1980s, where we had a recession, we had the farm crisis, and we had a huge decline in the number of family-owned farms. And that really affected the ability of people who lived in small towns and rural areas to make a life there, right?
That's right. And it wasn't just independent-owned family farms. It was family-owned businesses on Main Street as well. Car dealerships, implement dealers, five and dime stores, restaurants that really provided the fabric of rural communities, have also experienced the same declines that farm families have as well. The arrival of big box stores, of discounters, the consolidation in business that we're very familiar with in terms of family farms has also disrupted main streets throughout many of our small communities.
Well, in a lot of the towns that we really saw decline in Iowa, there have been people who have worked very hard to be intentional, to try to help Main Street make a comeback and thrive again. There have been some communities that have been very successful at this. There have been other communities in Iowa that haven't been successful. And then there are many other communities where nobody's really had the means or the drive to try to make that happen. What do you see as the state of small towns in this state today?
Well, it's an interesting conundrum. On the one hand, we have small communities within commuter distance of larger metro areas that are doing quite well. And those communities provide a higher quality of life. People want to live in those small communities for their quality of life, but they commute out of the town every day to the adjacent metro area. So they kind of have the best of both worlds. They have the amenities of urban living or workplace, but then they can retreat to the small communities. And across Iowa, we see a number of those small communities within that commuter belt of those urban areas that are doing quite well. It's when you move beyond those commuter belts where many rural communities are really struggling to find their future. What I've found very interesting is driving out in across the state and across the Midwest is one community you'll find is in dismal array, decline, vacant storefronts, all indications of economic despair. But you can drive a few miles down the road and find another community where things seem to be sort of congealing, that there's a renewed optimism. There are signs of prosperity and growth. I think it really comes down to the characteristics that you and John were talking about earlier about these remarkable individuals, and it's about leadership. In communities where you have strong leaders that say, you know, if we continue to allow these trends to continue, our community is going to finally disappear, that we need to make some investments to keep our young people here, to provide economic and social activities so that young people stay as opposed to fleeing. It really does come down to a collective sense of our future is in our own hands, and it's an issue of having the right leaders. And many of those communities that I've visited, you see, in some cases, a very, what I call, caring communities where people are concerned and they're beginning to work together to figure out ways for creative ways of providing goods and services and economic opportunities. The next community, it's characterized by apathy and despair.
During my conversation with John, we talked about the fact that so many of these individuals, almost all of these individuals, in fact, had to leave their small towns to pursue an education. Now, we have had a growth of community colleges doing different kinds of outreach around the state of Iowa. Is that still the case, that if you want to pursue a higher education, you have to get out of town?
Well, unfortunately, in many cases, that is the challenge. And once young people leave their community, it's reminiscent of the World War One song that came out after World War One. How are you going to keep them down on the farm when they've seen the lights of Paris?
Right.
I thought, the issue that John raises in his book was very interesting. He talked about grit and ambition. And I think the fundamental question sociologically is really the importance of community characteristics in personality and character formation or development. That it's experiences of living in a small community that accounts for why these folks have certain characteristics that made them successful. And I thought a bit about what are some of those experiences. You know, living in a small community where people tend to know each other, or at least they think they know each other. I've quoted that the nice thing about living in a small town is that when I don't know what I'm doing, surely someone else does. but it's knowing people across multiple dimensions of community. In fact, I've lectured on the importance of living in small communities because children and adolescents and young adults observe people working. And the value of work, you compare that with the experiences of urban children who see their parents leave of a morning and go someplace to work, but never actually observe their parents working. Those of us raised in small towns or on farms, the value of work was part of our culture because we seen people working, not only our parents but our neighbors, and we seen people working in a variety of activities. In my own case, while I was raised on a farm and in a small rural community, in fact, the largest town in our county was 700. So I certainly understand rural culture by my upbringing. There were certain jobs that I observed people doing that led me to say, I want to get an education so that I don't have to do X, Y, or Z.
Mm-hmm.
And I could observe that as a child growing up saying, I don't want to be a roofer. I'm afraid of height. I don't like cleaning out stalls in livestock facilities. So the reality is that the perceptions of work and how people make a living, I think, does probably contribute to this what I call personality formation. It's not only the value of work, however, it's also the values that are instilled in young people through important social institutions of rural communities, such as churches and schools, that one develops a set of values. Now, the counterpart to that is that in some communities, characteristics of communities may in fact thwart individual development and achievement. And I would point out such things as discrimination, of bullying behavior, of ostracizing those that, unlike ourselves, labeling behavior. Those are kind of things that I think are very disruptive to personality and character development. And so when I look at rural communities that are growing and thriving, you see that there's an intention of inclusiveness, of including people of different race and ethnicities and gender, and there's a strong prohibition against discrimination and bullying and labeling behavior, and you can sense that. Some communities are almost closed to outsiders, and yet other communities, they embrace diversity. So part of what I think we think about the future of rural communities is we need to hold up those values that are important to character development for children and youth development. In providing them social and economic opportunities to thrive.
Paul, when you look at the statistics, is there a disadvantage to coming from a small town? I mean, you talk about discrimination within the community. There's also discrimination in larger communities, sometimes against people from small towns. We do hear the word hick thrown around quite a lot. So are there measurable disadvantages?
Well, I suppose there are. You know, I come from Missouri, a small town in Missouri, and you know, I've had my fair share of being described as a hick or a hillbilly because I do have a different speech pattern and maybe a unique set of values and beliefs. But you know, I actually find that and I've been, of course, living here in Iowa now for 33 years, that people were very accepting. Now, does that mean that there's still not some out there? Well, undoubtedly there are. I may have been fortunate because of having a graduate degree that legitimated my skill set that others wouldn't. But, you know, I think, you know, fundamentally, if I would have been of a racial or ethnic minority, I would have faced, at least in some communities, discrimination, not about where I was raised, but by skin color or ethnicity. So I think, you know, and I applaud the work that's being done at the state level on anti-bullying. I think bullying behavior in schools is something that we cannot tolerate, and I applaud the efforts of the governor and the legislature in addressing that, because I think that those scars that oftentimes young people experience in the tender years of their development, they carry with them a long time. And we cannot afford to have that occur in urban or rural places.
Do you feel that that's more pronounced, that bullying culture can be more pronounced in small towns? Of course, it can happen anywhere.
Well, it does happen everywhere, but I don't know that it's any worse in rural communities, but we need to address that head on, that it is not acceptable. And we've made great strides, but clearly I think the practice of excluding people, and sometimes that's because they come from the wrong side of the track, the wrong family name, they don't have the right clothes, they don't dress or act like us. Those are very harmful comments and remarks that the young people experience that I think sometimes drives them out of rural communities.
And Paul, we're nearly out of time. So just in 15 seconds, you talked about seeing a number of communities in Iowa where you feel there's good leadership and progress being made to making these communities thriving. Are you feeling optimistic about the future of small towns?
I am. I think because in many ways what we're seeing is the collapse of many urban areas with congestion, pollution, crime. And I think if we do a good job in maintaining a rural social structure, that those communities will increasingly become desirable places to live.
Paul, thank you so much.
Charity, it's always fun to visit with you. I wish we had more time.
Yeah, and come back again soon. We'll come up with a reason for sure.
Great. Okay.
All right. Paul Lasley is the chair of the Sociology and Anthropology Departments at Iowa State University. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and we welcome back Lindsay Moon today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. This is Talk of Iowa.